This is Beyond the Ridge, the Vimy Foundation's conversational series in partnership with the National Film Board of Canada and supported by Veterans Affairs Canada. My name is Caitlin Bailey, the Vimy Foundation's Executive Director, and together we will be looking at the consequences of the First World War on the environment. This episode was originally broadcast as a webinar and features Dolph DeJong of the Toronto Zoo in conversation with Vimy Foundation program alumni, Rose He. Beyond the Ridge pairs Vimy Foundation program alumni with academic experts to discuss topics linked to the First World War from a contemporary perspective. Dolph DeJong is Chief Executive Officer of the Toronto Zoo since 2018. He has shaped the Toronto Zoo's vision of wildlife conservation and brought in new technologies, all the while working to improve access for underserved audiences. Rose He is a 2019 Beaverbrook Vimy Prize recipient, studying engineering at the University of New Brunswick. The Beaverbrook Vimy Prize takes Canadian, British, and French students on an educational journey across the historical battlefields of the First and Second World Wars in Belgium and France.
With climate change becoming an increasingly pressing issue, it is important that we talk about how some of the issues we see today arose from our history. When I traveled to Belgium and France to study the two world wars, I was genuinely surprised to see the changes that made to the landscape during conflict, which still remain over 100 years later. I'm incredibly excited to talk about the environmental implications and consequences of the First and Second World Wars and how they tie in with current issues today. When researching the First World War, many historical photos show bare, war-torn, trench-filled battlefields. With this in mind, Dolph, could you explain how the wars affected the landscape of countries?
It's really fascinating when you look into these periods in our history, that conflict, and you know, as Canadians, we know so much about how it impacted our cultural landscape as a coming-of-age moment, the significant loss of life, the tragedy of losing 60,000 young people out of a population of 8 million. It was huge, but the theater of war was far afield in Europe, and the scale of it for many Canadians, it might seem elusive, but we're talking 1,000 kilometers stretching from Belgium to Switzerland, and literally this line of trenches and supporting routes, providing supplies for this band of conflict that was going on. And I think we'll start off by actually showing a clip from Paris 1919, which is a film directed by Paul Cowan and co-produced by our own National Film Board of Canada, Gala Films, and Production 13. And it does a really good job describing that impact. So I'm just going to pull that up now.
420,000 men died in Verdun. 9 villages disappeared. There's not a single tree standing.
When we talk about that scale, you know, not a single tree standing, villages literally being erased from the landscape, just catastrophic destruction and loss of life as these groups of individuals dug in. And you can see from historical images the pattern as they had their zigzagged trenches, the support lines, the supply lines, soldiers as just tiny pieces when you look at aerial photos of that. And a pattern that may look haphazard, but was a key strategic design to minimize loss of life in a world where the conflict was largely ruled by hand-to-hand combat and shelling. This was built to survive these blast patterns, and it really was looking at the environment from a pure strategic lens, high ground, shelter, cover, what is the substrate? So really having a huge, huge impact on that band along the line.
So you described 1,000 kilometers of trenches from Belgium to Switzerland and how these zigzagging patterns reflected the strategy to avoid shelling and blasts. These mostly describe how the built environment shaped the landscape. Could you elaborate more about the impacts of the conflict itself?
There was a quote I picked up in my research. It talked about the Western Front's environment exemplifying contradiction. It appeared simultaneously gruesome, scarred with splintered trees and churned up meadows, mettled with human gore, but also pleasant, covered in bright green grass and full of colorful wildflowers and on occasion thriving wildlife. So you had these really contradicting pieces coming together. And, you know, those battlefields, when we start talking about scale of impact, from the First World War data sets, they're saying the German artillery fired approximately 222 million rounds of artillery. So this barrage, and they could hurl those projectiles up to 120 kilometers along that line. And it's now estimated that for every square meter of territory on the front from the coast to the Swiss border, a ton of explosives fell. So you're trying to wrap your head around the scale of that, both from a human tragedy point of view, but also as far as just tearing up the ground. And we dig a little deeper into that, and we learn that one in four of those shells actually didn't detonate. They became embedded in the ground and now have become an annual rite of passage in the spring and fall. As farmers in Belgium, they talk a lot about their iron harvest at those times of year as they collect those, place them on the roadsides, and continue to deal with the legacy of the conflict. And it wasn't just the large munitions. You know, you'll hear of individual battles that were done, for instance, where 60 million rounds of ammunition were fired on the battlefield. Much of that continues to be there to this day. Those explosions destroyed the vegetation, reshaped and lowered the landscape in some cases, compacting it, remixed soil layers, fractured the underlying bedrock. And as Rose talked about in her introduction, those legacies, in many cases, you can still see today, over 100 years after the wars ended.
So there were millions upon millions of rounds that were fired and detonated, leaving lasting craters on the land. You mentioned that roughly a quarter didn't even explode, and now people are still finding these munitions in the land through the iron harvest every single year. That's almost unbelievable. So from what I understand, there were also some lesser known strategies used in trench warfare, such as tunneling below the enemy's position. What type of impact did that have?
So, you know, many of us have seen the imagery of those zigzag trenches on the surface. But when you looked at one of the key strategies to get behind those at times, you could try to go head to head or you could go underneath. And there were many cases where these incredibly long tunnels would be dug, in some cases used to get in behind enemy lines and infiltrate, or to plant explosives and have these absolutely massive explosions to try to destroy the enemy's position. And, you know, when we talk about the shelling, you know, you'd be talking about large impact craters. Here's an example of one with a soldier standing in it for scale from the First World War. And, you know, while that seems large, it's actually tiny when you compare it to Loch Nagan crater. And this is actually visible from space to this day. And this is actually right below where the German lines were, and British soldiers mined. They tunneled underneath, planted a huge amount of explosives, packed it there, detonated it on July 1st, 1916. It was Canada Day, before we knew it was Canada Day. And that explosion produced a crater that's 100 meters wide and 21 meters deep. So absolutely enormous. And when you look at the imagery of it today, it's just this just incredible contradiction as we think about what that day must have looked like and the huge human tragedy. But when we look at it present day, it's surrounded by farm fields, and the area of the crater has actually had trees growing back in, the vegetation get reestablished. So here's this place that was completely altered. Nature has taken it back, but because of that damage, continues to be a protected space. It's an interesting tension as we look at those disturbed spaces over time. And all those explosions, I talked a little bit about the habitat and the soil and the gravel mixing up, churning up. These would have huge impacts on the water table, on how water flew off the site as it all mixed together into one really impassable matrix, and could lead to other issues afterwards, such as, you know, landslides or sedimentation of water, real problems. So those impacts are really quite clear when you look at that historic imagery, as you see huge pools of standing water. We see vernal and ephemeral pools frequently in forest settings, but not quite like this, where standing, stagnant water, no vegetation to be seen, all of it representing a huge barrier to wildlife. Habitat connectivity is a key piece for successful wildlife populations, animals being able to get together. So this band essentially dividing that part of Europe in two and being suitable mainly for invasive and less desirable species that we still see in low quality living environments to this day, rats, lice, fleas, the few species who really can thrive in that. And to this day, you have to look at it through the different ideas of timelines and scale. From a geological time point of view, you know, where we've carved out the rock and the soil, it's still pretty clear where the conflict took place. You can see the bands and the ribbons, the shell holes from a flora point of view, from the plants. The trees have become established as we look at, you know, a living organism that lives for a century or a few centuries. And then the fauna, last but not least, coming back once that vegetation's there, and some of them having shorter lifespans, you know, white-tailed deer 10, 20 years, to other ones that are very short-lived, you know, less than a year, moving back into those spaces. So I'm actually going to pull up another clip quickly here, again, from Paris 1919, because we described it a little bit, and there's a great example here of the German delegation when they're coming into northern France and their perception of what they've seen.
Walter Siemens, the lawyer for the German delegation, often writes to his wife during this time.
Der erste Eindruck von den besetzten Gebieten ließ meine Seele verdorren. Dann allerdings kam Nordfrankreich. Es war eine erschütternde Erfahrung, obwohl wir von Bildern und Beschreibungen wussten, wie ein Schlachtfeld aussah.
That harrowing experience, even if you know what battlefield looks like, just such a stark reminder of the scale of that conflict and the impact.
So most of what we have already discussed, trenches, shelling, explosives, and how it affected the landscape, deals with the direct impact of the battlefield. Like you mentioned, the impacts are clear and evident with the massive craters left on the land and the sheer destruction left behind. Like you mentioned, even the German delegation was surprised by the sheer devastation. Now, I'm a bit curious about the environmental impact on the home front, something which may not be as apparent as the landscape damage that is seen on the battlefield.
Yeah, I found this really interesting when we started to dig in the resources to fuel the war. When you're talking 60 million soldiers being deployed, needing to be supported on all sides, that led to scarcity and altered consumption habits, both for industry and for civilians. And the major items, really, you know, you think about food, lumber, metals, fuel being the key items there.
Can you go through those different items? Can you discuss how an increased demand for these supplies and the mass production of these goods during the wartime period affected the environment?
Yeah, certainly. You know, you look at Britain as an island nation importing a lot of its food. About 80% of its wheat prior to the war was coming from abroad. And when we think about those 60 million soldiers, you look at the age group they're in, it's not synonymous, but it's pretty close. You can think of 60 million people who can't or are not farming. Part of what we saw was a shift in agricultural practices and that shift to industrial agriculture as we needed to increase production and the messaging that people were receiving, food will win the war, we'll win the war with wheat, drove huge demand and actually moved the price of wheat significantly as well, from 78 cents a bushel before the war to a high in Canada of $2.63 afterwards, as people really stepped up to support that. And that demand and increased price, increased production, and increased the amount of habitat used to grow that wheat. So that's where you start talking about an impact to the natural world, where in that four-year period, we see a 14 million acre increase in the amount of space used to grow wheat in the United States. And some people say that's pretty modest if you look at what happened in Canada and the US combined, as much as a doubling at that time. So we're seeing that increase in space. We're seeing a rise of technology and tractors to help cultivate that. And with that increase in mechanization, we see an increase in habitat loss. And that is actually a key hypothesis in what happened to the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. We ramped up agriculture through the late 19-teens. It resulted in marginal farmland being used and a lot of traditional prairie being cleared and turned into grain and plowed. And when we had the drought conditions, it wasn't as resilient. And we literally saw huge parts of the prairies blowing away, a huge environmental impact, a huge part of subsequent challenges with recession, and no doubt a huge impact to a lot of the species that are native to this area that called it home.
So food was important for a country's messaging. Farmers were encouraged by the government to win the war with wheat. And as a result, there was a major expansion and industrialization of farms. Production increased significantly and thousands of individuals were recruited to work as farmers. All this expansion meant a destruction of habitat. So what did this mean for forests?
Yeah, it's a great question when you actually think about the forest. The trenches, tunnels of the front lines, the barracks, the supporting buildings, all required a huge amount of timber to build. And forests were of significant strategic importance for those resources, but also for cover. When we look at, again, the data for the first 700 kilometers of trenches, they estimated over 500,000 square meters of timber used. And over the course of the war, the narrative, the estimates have it at about 2.5 billion board feet of lumber consumed, destroyed, removed, and deployed. So huge, huge impacts on forests, the source of all that wood. It was forests in northern France that were decimated at first. In fact, the army actually had an officer placed in charge, a military liaison, that could stop delegations from other countries, the British, from what they described as anarchic exploitation. You know, they understood the importance of protecting pieces of these forests to protect other natural, supporting natural resources, such as their water, preventing erosion. And those French foresters actually could say no to felling of trees, even for the war effort. So a really interesting strategic piece there. At the peak, you're talking just under 44,000 workers in this field in 1917, 1918, just cutting and providing lumber, just an amazing spin up to provide that valuable resource through the conflict, but with huge local impacts, as you saw, old growth largely removed, irresponsible forestry practices resulting in washouts, degradation of water bodies, and longer term legacies as it takes so long for those forests to get reestablished.
You mentioned 2.5 billion board feet of timber destroyed or consumed. Such an immense scale of forest destruction is almost difficult to understand. These numbers that you discuss are mostly about Europe, though. 22,000 acres of forest destroyed in Belgium alone, in France seeing local extinctions, landslides, and sedimentation. You also briefly mentioned across the world. What did this forest destruction mean for North America?
Yeah, this is another area where the war came home to North America, particularly with regards to the West Coast forest and Sitka spruce. It was really important material for the construction of airplanes. It was light, it was strong, and they saw production over a few years of the war increase from just under 3 million to over 22 million board feet annually to meet the needs of the military as planes became one of the key tools in the conflict. And what does that mean? It means the loss of a huge number of trees, yes, but equally challenging for the natural world is the supporting logging roads, the mills, the new routes for invasive species to move in those places, and the habitat fragmentation that goes on that presents challenges to wildlife. So fueling that war overseas profoundly changed our forests right here on the west coast of North America for a period. And it's a bit of an interesting one for us because it's also a source of significant Canadian pride. Our 224th Canadian Forestry Battalion worked in Canada as well as overseas. And the British government had concluded who better, who more experienced and qualified than Canadians to harvest timber. And at the peak, we had 35,000 Canadians serving in that corps. And it's believed we produced about 70% of the lumber used by the Allies in World War I. So a huge piece of strategic importance and something certainly we could be proud of as our contribution, but no question, huge ecological impact here and abroad.
Of course, the consequences on these forests were significant, but the environmental implications must go beyond trees. What else was impacted?
One of the pieces that I hadn't even considered was tin as a key component of metal alloys used in axles, in bushings and bearings. It's an anti-friction material that was often mined through open pits. And the biggest impact for that actually was in Malaysia, what's now Malaysia, the Dutch Indies at the time, where they saw huge increases in demand for this product, huge increases in price, but huge impact on the natural environment, where they literally cultivated tens of thousands of acres and worked to dig that out of the ground. Those mines, they're quite a scar on the landscape as they dig down. The extraction process is invasive. The processing of it to extract the ore leaves quite a legacy, and that's still very much there today. The other key item was fossil fuels, whether it was gasoline, oil for the vehicles or coal for the steel mills. They were of major strategic importance. And you saw countries like Mexico being major players in the petroleum trade, Germany actually invading Ukraine to access more coal in 1918. These were critical resources for individual war efforts and at those times left a significant environmental legacy in their wake.
It seems like the increased demand that came with the war required an incredible amount of resources in many different industries, such as wood, non-renewables, such as tin and coal. Some of these environmental consequences must have been expected. Now, I'm wondering, what were some unexpected environmental consequences of the war?
Yeah, when we think about the battlefields, you know, many of those areas were pretty well developed already. We'd been literally farming there for millennia. But, you know, the removal of trees and a lot of that cover, so people had long sight lines, really had an impact on large mammals and birds. Longer lived species, things like European oaks, removed, destroyed, and weren't replanted in most cases. We saw a transition to faster growing softwoods and conifers like pine and spruce. And the result of that mass planting event at one time, a good thing to try to get nature to recover, is now we have monoculture plantations that are often all aging out and dying at the same time. And those monocultures aren't as robust and resilient to disease. So some really clear impacts in the theaters of war. Outside of that area, what was interesting is how when Europe entered into the war, it was a key production center. It was kind of the industrial heart almost of the world, with a few spots in North America added. When they came offline, a lot of those other areas started having to provide their own materials. So you saw this industrial development and that spin up of urbanization and those industrial factories popping up all over the world, which was really sped through the need generated through the war.
So some environmental consequences were that forests weren't as rich. They were all planted at the same time and they were all dying at the same time. And that the industrialization grew due to the detriment of Western Europe. These impacts that you discussed, both expected and unexpected, seem quite significant and far-reaching. It's almost difficult to truly understand the extent of these consequences. What happened to all of these environmental destruction and the pollution of battlefields following the war?
Yeah, well, you know, you had these completely modified environments through shelling, through human activity, plants and long-living trees largely gone. And a lot of individuals actually took the steps, cleaned that up, the government supported. And people actually talk about it, that, you know, it was unbelievable, the scale of the damage. But amazingly, within half a decade, you hear stories of folks visiting back in the 20s and saying, nature has things coming back. It's starting to reclaim things. But you'd still have the physical legacies there, the geological ones, as well as the major structures that were built. And when I actually fast forward to the Second World War, they talk about, with the shelling and the impact of the two wars combined, that it'll likely be 700 years until a lot of those ordinances are safe and those spaces can be really inhabited without any fear again. And the government won't have to have those teams in place to be pulling out shells that continue to come to the surface to this day.
These environmental impacts seem complicated and difficult to resolve. Like you mentioned, in France, it will probably take roughly 700 years until certain areas truly become safe? Did countries attempt to mitigate these consequences and work towards recovery?
Absolutely, you know, and that work started almost instantly. In 1919, they were already talking about farming and getting the first 4 hectares of certain areas going, and a year later that had expanded to literally hundreds. So it's an amazing story of nature's resilience and recovery in some cases, but it's very speciesist. In some cases, they talk about only the trees keep a record of their suffering. Those perennials, those annuals that grow back seasonally, they recover a lot faster than those hardwoods and the rest of it that once gone literally will take a human lifetime to come back. The other thing we've watched come back is these forests. And we talked about the monoculture. Here's an example of a conifer one. They're replanted. They're usually fast growing with commercially valuable species. But they change the whole composition of the ecosystem and what lives there. And that has a real legacy piece. The good news is once you get those roots in the ground, you stop some of the erosion, some of the runoff, you can stabilize stream edges and the rest of it and not have to deal with as much hardscape. So part of that recovery is getting nature, and in some cases, giving nature that head start.
In some cases, recovery has been slow, but in the end, nature has proven itself to be resilient. Could you elaborate more about how nature has recovered from the impact of the war? Has recovery been successful, or have there been some irreversible consequences?
Oh, there's no question that when we lose pieces of nature, it takes a long time, if it can ever come back. And that's particularly true at the battlefield site, where Some people see all plants in green as good, but invasive species and other compositions have changed things dramatically. But when you think beyond the front, when you look at the habitat that was lost, you look at the fossil fuel work that went on in the Gulf of Mexico, the environmental legacy there and the damage of those quick developments and spills lasted for decades. In other places, you can still see the impact of deforestation and agricultural expansion. Those wild spaces, you know, are far smaller than they've ever been and maybe too small to actually provide adequate habitat for certain species. And when you fast forward to some of the present day conflicts, we think of Vietnam, where they literally dropped 70 million liters of herbicides, you know, Agent Orange, DDT, to remove forests, to be able to engage in conflict, to see the enemy and the impacts of actually putting those dioxins. They persist in the soil to this day. We've seen huge decreases in biodiversity of birds, mammals. It's incredibly sad to see how that incredibly rich jungle of Vietnam has declined. Those dioxins also have a huge impact on humans who live there today. It's in fish, it's in fowl, and children have a very high rate of blindness, blood disease, and birth defects as an environmental legacy. The other example that really hurts when we look at the natural world is the first Gulf War, where the scorched earth policy upon retreat. We're talking oil spills to the tune of 4 to 6 million barrels and slicks that were 160 kilometers wide, 68 kilometers long, and 13 centimeters thick. So, you know, imagine that much oil just sitting on a water body and the impact. That's far larger than an Exxon Valdez. That's in the scope of a deep water horizon. And those legacies, they haunt us to this day.
So millions upon millions of barrels of oil and 70 million liters of toxic herbicides such as Agent Orange and DDT were spilled across ecosystems with lasting effects. I'm wondering, Dolph, how did or how do these consequences impact the individuals residing in these affected regions?
I think there's the immediate effect, right? When you talk about literally villages being wiped off the face of the earth and reestablishing that to the farming, to those wild spaces. But back here, when you leave the theater of war, you picture our Canadian and American prairies, where literally millions of hectares gone, habitat for prairie dogs, for sage grouse, for animals like this is a black-footed ferret that we actually are doing breeding, recovery and release at our Toronto Zoo. They're still struggling a century later from the rapid agricultural expansion and shortness of habitats and habitat fragmentation. Those are really real challenges. When you think of the tin mines that we talked about, you know, Malaysia is one of the most densely populated countries in the world. That space is really important to recover so they can have more space for housing. And there's literally 14,000 square kilometers lost right now to that legacy. So it makes us reflect on changes to our environment over time, the ones we can see in our lifetime. And then when we really look in the time machine and look back, what did good used to look like and how much have we lost since then?
There have been so many changes to our environment over time. It's almost hard to imagine how we can work towards a healthy environment. However, we have to start somewhere. Dolph, do you think we can see any similarities between environmental issues today and those from the world wars?
Well, I think there's certainly something to think about there. In periods of crisis, you know, we'll do whatever we can to survive, and humans will use nature, exploit nature as required, and at unprecedented levels at times like that. I also think there's a really clear line between politics and the politics of the day and their view on environment and economy and how we need that healthy environment to have a thriving economy. And it's scary, I think, when we look to the future. We see damaged landscapes and ecosystems. We see biodiversity loss at an unprecedented rate. And all that's important because as we lose those species, yes, it's a tragedy, but it also makes those ecosystems less stable and more prone to collapse if additional pressures are added. And those are beyond climate change or the other threats that are under today. So when we think of healthy ecosystems, you know, they're not going to be filled with stressed animals who are shedding viruses and animals on the edges of the range. Those are big threats to nature recovering quickly and big threats to us as we think about the origins of this pandemic, as we see zoonotic diseases making that jump from animal populations to us.
I find it very interesting how you mentioned that damaged and vulnerable ecosystems lead to increased risks of diseases and viruses, especially since we are, as you said, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. Before we wrap up our discussion, Dolph, do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share?
One of the things that I kept bumping into is this notion of human impact in the environment, conflict, accidents. and what they called accidental wildlife sanctuaries. We see, you know, biodiversity actually increasing and improving in some cases where we have minefields. The area around Chernobyl has become this park where megafauna is actually making a resurgence. So it's an interesting perspective on human impact on the natural world, and sometimes our persistence, presence being so detrimental to other species. So what can we learn from our past so we make sure we don't repeat it? And how do we protect the natural world on purpose, as opposed to what we're seeing in some cases nowadays, which is these protected spaces being set aside for other reasons with such painful histories?
In a period of crisis, the human drive to survive can result in massive exploitation at unprecedented levels. And such was the case during the two world wars and with the plastic waste boom we see today with the current COVID-19 pandemic. As Dolph discussed, by examining our history, we can discover how some environmental issues that we see today arose, and we see similarities between the overproduction of goods and the exploitation of natural resources during the world wars in our modern day industries. We are seeing how these issues, past and current, leave lasting impressions on people, flora and fauna, landscape, and the overall environment. From looking back at our history, we can look forward and face the issues of our present and our future.
I would like to thank our series partners, the National Film Board of Canada, for the short film clip from Paris, and Veterans Affairs Canada for support of Beyond the Ridge. And finally, our partner for the original webinar, the Toronto Zoo. The Toronto Zoo aims at connecting people, animals, and conservation science in the objective of fighting extinction of species and saving wildlife. It is also a leader in the use of new technologies in a zoo setting. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and stay tuned, because there are many more in the Vimy Foundation's Beyond the Ridge series. In the next episodes, we will be looking at topics such as the War Measures Act, commemorations, and the making of war documentaries. Please join me again. Until next time, this is Beyond the Ridge. Beyond the Ridge is a Vimy Foundation podcast, produced in partnership with the National Film Board of Canada and supported by Veterans Affairs Canada. Building the future informed by the past. The Vimy Foundation works to preserve and promote Canada's ongoing legacy of leadership, as symbolized by the First World War victory at Vimy Ridge in April 1917, a milestone where Canada came of age and was recognized on the world stage.